Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and in this segment we're going to be taking a look at some of the past history and behavior of Louis Farrakhan, the leader of the Nation of Islam. In particular, we're going to be taking a look at some of Farrakhan's behavior vis-a-vis what, for lack of a better term, one might call the politics of murder. There are a number of things about Farrakhan's past that I personally do not care for. Farrakhan, it should be noted, is one of the icons of the fascist third position, an element of the international fascist movement that attempts to recruit people from the more progressive political sector to a fascist agenda. In the past, he has had cozy relations with white supremacists, including Robert Miles, a Michigan white supremacist, who had a white supremacist congress or gathering on his property in Michigan. Farrakhan was an honored guest at that. I would also note that Farrakhan's behavior vis-a-vis the assassination of Malcolm X, the man whose mantle he has assumed, warrants serious scrutiny. Now, I have not got time to go into all of the details concerning the assassination of Malcolm X in this particular segment. Suffice it to say that the available evidence suggests very strongly that the executive authority with regard to the assassination of Malcolm X was the same faction of our national security establishment that was involved in the assassinations of John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and a great many other people. There remain some very serious questions, however, concerning Farrakhan's behavior vis-a-vis the assassination of Malcolm X. I want to make it very clear that there is not enough evidence at this point to state that Farrakhan was involved in the assassination of Malcolm X. However, the evidence points in that direction, and the family of Malcolm X, among others, are among those who believe that Farrakhan was. Again, for the record, I want to state that there is not enough evidence at this point by a long shot to state that Farrakhan was involved in the assassination. However, there isn't enough evidence at this point to exonerate him completely either. I think there are some serious questions to be answered with regard to Farrakhan's behavior vis-a-vis Malcolm's assassination. I want to make it clear I do not have those answers. Those answers should be looked for by investigators and historians, and I also want to state for the record I doubt seriously that they will. However, with Louis Farrakhan having emerged as arguably the most influential black American leader in the wake of the Million Man March, I think there are some very serious questions to be asked and answered about whether this is an individual who deserves that kind of power. Hence, the following discussion, Louis Farrakhan and the politics of murder. We're going to be relying for our information on what is arguably the best book about the assassination of Malcolm X. We're going to be reading this evening from, or in this segment, from a book called The Judas Factor, subtitled The Plot to Kill Malcolm X. That was authored by Carl Evanz, K-A-R-L, capital E-V-A-N-Z-Z. The book was published in hardcover by the Thunder's Mouth Press, and it is copyrighted 1992. Carl Evanz is described on the back leaf as a freelance writer whose articles have appeared in the Washington Post, Southern Exposure, Black Film and Review, and numerous other publications. He is currently on the staff of the Washington Post. The first passage from The Judas Factor that we're going to be examining, and again I want to make it clear at this point that there is not enough evidence to say that Farrakhan was involved in the assassination of Malcolm X. However, there are a number of things that point in that direction, and I think a clarification of the historical record is in everybody's best interest, with the possible exception of Louis Farrakhan. The growing conflict between Malcolm X and Elijah Muhammad, the leader of the Nation of Islam, concerned a number of sexual improprieties on the part of Elijah Muhammad, and also the funding of the Nation of Islam that was being undertaken by H.L. Hunt, the ultra-right-wing Texas billionaire. That is discussed, by the way, in The Judas Factor. The result of that split between Malcolm X and Elijah Muhammad was that the Nation of Islam began issuing very pointed verbal attacks on Malcolm X, and many of those attacks were issued by Louis X. One of the things that is discussed in The Judas Factor is that Elijah Muhammad believed that Louis X, by the way, that is what Louis Farrakhan was known at this time, that Louis X, although he revered Malcolm X, was himself very ambitious, and that in the event that Malcolm X was eliminated, i.e. killed, Louis X might very well be willing to assume Malcolm X's role as the chief spokesperson for the Nation of Islam. Carl Evans describes Elijah Muhammad's perceptions concerning Louis X, now Louis Farrakhan, and his ambitions vis-a-vis Malcolm X as follows. Muhammad knew that Louis X worshipped Malcolm X, but he also knew that Louis X was ambitious, and that with Malcolm X out of the way, Louis X had to know that the odds were very good that he would replace Malcolm X as the national spokesman for the Nation of Islam. Given those odds, Muhammad figured that Louis X would turn his back on his mentor. On January 7, 1964, the FBI taped a conversation involving Elijah Muhammad which should have, but didn't, result in his arrest, or should have resulted in his arrest, excuse me. The messenger made a veiled reference to killing Malcolm X. Quote, "It's time to close his eyes," unquote, Elijah Muhammad said. When the Chicago Bureau of the FBI received transcriptions of the tapes chronicling its successful COINTELPRO against Malcolm X and Elijah Muhammad, it sent a boastful memorandum to Hoover at FBI headquarters. Again, I want to note for the record, we have not got time to go into the full record of the assassination of Malcolm X. The evidence, as presented by Carl Evans in this excellent book, suggests that the executive authority was indeed the same faction of our national security establishment that was behind the assassinations of John and Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and a great many other people as well. Although the trigger men who performed the assassination were certainly in the employ of the Nation of Islam, the executive authority was well beyond the Nation of Islam. However, I think the behavior of Louis Farrakhan with regard to the assassination of Malcolm X, as with regard to a great many other aspects of Louis Farrakhan's behavior, warrants much more serious scrutiny and should be being criticized far more emphatically than it is. The next segment of the Judas Factor that we're going to be examining in this particular segment concerns the growing activities of Malcolm X in forming political liaisons with diplomatic representatives of various black African nations, including Mr. Kazon Saki. I'm not sure how that's pronounced. I've never heard it spoken aloud. Q-U-A-I-S-O-N hyphen S-A-C-K-E-Y. A Ghanaian diplomat. Mr. Kazon Saki had been elected president of the UN General Assembly in 1965, or actually in 1964, and this was of concern to the powers that be in this country because Malcolm X was already in close contact with Kazon Saki. As noted by Carl Evans in the Judas Factor, the public call in the Nation of Islam's newspaper, Muhammad Speaks, by Malcolm X, or by, Louis X, then the name that Louis Farrakhan was using then, which contains a thinly veiled death threat against Malcolm X, was issued at this very time, perhaps coincidentally, perhaps not. The relationship between Malcolm X and Kazon Saki, the president of the UN General Assembly, the call issued by Louis X, now Louis Farrakhan, in Muhammad Speaks for Malcolm X's death, is described by Carl Evans as follows. On December 3rd, the FBI discovered that Malcolm X had had several recent meetings with Kazon Saki. Ordinarily, this would have been of little or no importance. The Bureau, after all, had observed Malcolm X over the last 6 months in the presence of diplomats Pio de Gama Pinto of Kenya, Frank Karifa Smart, K-A-R-E-F-A hyphen S-M-A-R-T of Sierra Leone, and Abdul Rahman Babu of Tanzania, that's B-A-B-U. But given the war in the Congo, the rancorous relationship between the Johnson administration and Nkrumah of Ghana, whom U.S. Ambassador Douglas Dillon labeled, quote, another Castro, unquote, and the fact that Kazon Saki had been elected president of the UN General Assembly on December 1st, things were anything but ordinary. The FBI's New York field office sent a memo to Hoover reacquainting him with Malcolm X's four-year relationship with Kazon Saki and reflecting on possible national security problems their friendship could create. Part of the memo read, "With the return of Malcolm X Little from his African trip, the possibility exists that additional coverage of his activities is desirable, particularly since he intends to have the Negro question brought before the United Nations, or UN. The possibility also exists that Little may soon be changing his residence. This intensified coverage may take the form of spot-check surveillances." It is noted that Alex Kazon Saki, Ghanaian ambassador to the UN, has been elected president of the UN. And then, by the way, it should be noted that the FBI was referring to Malcolm X by his given name, Malcolm Little. Then Carly Bonds goes on to describe the veiled death threat, thinly veiled call for Malcolm X's death that was issued in Muhammad Speaks by Louis X, or Louis Farrakhan, as he calls himself now. Carly Bonds goes on to say, "The reference to Malcolm X's change of residence wasn't a reflection of the Bureau's interest in the revolutionary's upward mobility. It was mentioned merely so wiretaps on his home telephone and bugging devices in his residence could be transferred. The same day, Muhammad Speaks issued what amounted to Malcolm X's death warrant. Attributed to Louis X. Farrakhan of Boston, the article stated in part, only those who wish to be led to hell or to their doom will follow Malcolm. The die is set, and Malcolm shall not escape, especially after such evil, foolish talk about his benefactor, Elijah Muhammad, in trying to rob him of the divine glory which Allah has bestowed upon him. Such a man as Malcolm is worthy of death, and would have met death if it had not been for Muhammad's confidence in Allah for victory over his enemies." Louis X. Farrakhan also implied that Malcolm X had tried to use Elijah Muhammad's former secretaries, the very ones who filed the paternity actions, to assist him in, quote, planning Muhammad's overthrow, unquote. And then Evans goes on to note that perhaps coincidentally or perhaps not, it was at the very time that Malcolm X was forming some of the political liaisons with black African leaders, including Alex Kazan Saki, that this particular thinly veiled death threat was issued. Perhaps it was merely coincidental that the veiled death threats began appearing in Muhammad Speaks within days of Kazan Saki's elevation to president of the UN General Assembly. One thing is for certain. The FBI and CIA were closely monitoring Malcolm X's relationship with Kazan Saki after December 2nd, as well as his meeting with other African leaders and with Che Guevara. The next segment of the Judas Factor that we're going to be looking at concerns Louis X's, now Louis Farrakhan's, curious behavior around the time of the assassination of Malcolm X, specifically on the date of Malcolm X's assassination. Again, I want to state that there is not enough evidence, certainly, to state that Louis Farrakhan was involved in the assassination. However, the evidence points in that direction, and I think there is much important research to be done in order to clarify the facts concerning Farrakhan's, then Louis X's, behavior vis-a-vis the assassination of the man whose mantle he has assumed. Returning to the Judas Factor by Carly Bonds, several FBI agents, for reasons which remain unclear, contacted sources in the Boston Mosque on February 21st to determine the whereabouts of Louis X. Farrakhan. Farrakhan, the FBI noted, quote, did not appear at the Boston Temple at the Sunday afternoon services. No one seems to know where Louis X. Farrakhan was during that period, or if, in fact, he was actually out of town, but his absence from services was noted, unquote. Then Evans goes on to note that according to Farrakhan himself, as researched by Carl Evans, he was at the Newark, New Jersey mosque when Malcolm X was assassinated, and Evans also notes that it's unusual that no one in that mosque was aware of his plans to be in Newark, and also that the four black Muslims who conspired with another of the assassins, a Mr. Hayer, to kill Malcolm X were members of the Newark mosque. Continuing with the Judas Factor. According to Louis X. Farrakhan, he was at the Newark mosque when Malcolm X was assassinated. It seems bizarre that no one in the mosque was aware of his plans to be in Newark. Oddly enough, the four black Muslims who Hayer said conspired with him to assassinate Malcolm X, Ben X. Thomas, a.k.a. Ben Thompson, Leon X. Davis, William X., and Wilbur X., were members of the Newark mosque. Again, I think in light of the behavior of Farrakhan vis-a-vis Malcolm's assassination, and in particular in light of some subsequent statements that Farrakhan has made, including one statement which basically, I'm going to paraphrase it, said, so what if we, first person plural, did kill him? What business is it of yours, referring to white people? One certainly does not want to use the first person plural when talking about murder. Among the many grotesque aspects of Louis Farrakhan's political pedigree that have not received the notice due them, there's been a fair amount of discussion concerning his various forms of bigotry, including his virulent anti-Semitism. Louis Farrakhan's, or Louis X, as he was called then, behavior with regard to the brutal murder of a breakaway Muslim sect called the Hanafis warrants serious consideration in light of the growing power and the mainstreaming of Louis Farrakhan in the wake of the Million Man March. as was the case vis-a-vis Farrakhan's behavior with regard to the Malcolm X assassination. Farrakhan was essentially a mouthpiece for the Nation of Islam and, in effect, justified and used, not only justified the brutal murders that I'm about to describe, but also used those murders in what I think could be fairly labeled an attempt to warn or intimidate future enemies of the Nation of Islam. In light of what listeners are about to hear, I think they should seriously evaluate whether Farrakhan is an individual who should be wearing the mantle of power that he now wears with regard to the power politics of Black America. Returning once again to The Judas Factor by Carl Evans. In January of 1973, Louis X, who had become the national spokesman for the Nation of Islam, was again making veiled threats against anyone who dared criticize the messenger. The latest was issued after Elijah Muhammad, Louis X, and every other black Muslim minister received a letter from a man who called himself Hamas Abdul Khalis, K-H-A-A-L-I-S. Khalis, as it turned out, was Ernest T. 2X McGee, the former black Muslim national secretary demoted by Malcolm X in favor of John Ali in 1958. By the way, John Ali, a member of the Nation of Islam, was described by Carl Evans in his book as working undercover with the FBI. Continuing, after leaving the Nation of Islam, Khalis had formed an orthodox Islamic sect known as the Hanafi. The sect's headquarters were located in a home on 16th Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., which had been purchased by basketball star Lou Alcindor, who had joined the sect and been renamed Kareem Abdul-Jabbar by Khalis. Dated January 5th, the scathing three-page letter to Muhammad denounced him as a, quote, lying deceiver, unquote, as well as questioned the character of NOI founder Wallace D. Fard. Khalis even called to question the legitimacy of NOI's basis in the Holy Quran. On January 17th, 1973, an eight-member black Muslim hit squad from the Philadelphia Mosque piled into a 1969 Cadillac and another vehicle and headed for Khalis's home on 16th Street in Washington, a middle-class community known as the Gold Coast, quote-unquote. At a cheap motel that evening, they made final plans to assassinate Khalis. The next morning, a member of the team telephoned Khalis's home to inquire about purchasing pamphlets written by the Hanafi. He was given directions to the home, and he then promised to stop by the next day. When the hit squad arrived at the 16th Street home, Khalis was away visiting friends and his wife was out shopping. But Almina Khalis, A-L-M-I-N-A, the leader's 23-year-old daughter, was there, as were her 25-year-old brother Daoud, D-A-U-D, and several small children. After Daoud sold two of the strangers some pamphlets, a third man claiming to be a repairman came to the door. While Daoud was telling him how to get to the rear entrance, the black Muslim suddenly assaulted him and forced their way into the house. Within seconds, all eight of the armed Philadelphia black Muslims were in the home. Daoud was taken to a bedroom on the third floor and forced to kneel on a prayer rug. A pillow was placed against his head as one of the gunmen shot him point blank three times. Almina was dragged upstairs next. Quote, "Why did you write those letters?" unquote, the assailants asked again and again. Using a shirt to muffle the sound of gunfire, the assassins forced Almina into a closet on the third floor and shot her three times in the head. Rahman, or Rahman, R-A-H-M-A-N, Almina Khalis's 10-year-old brother, became the next victim. The killers dragged the fragile child into the bedroom where Almina had been locked only moments earlier. Quote, "I'll do anything you say," unquote, the child pleaded. "Just don't hurt me," unquote. "Okay," one of the gunmen said, and then pumped two bullets point blank into the boy's skull, killing him instantly. Almina must have screamed at that very moment because the killer rushed to the closet where she lay dying. After discovering that she was still breathing, a gunman shot her two more times, again in the head. Meanwhile, Abdul Nur, N-U-R, a young Hanafi member who had gone shopping with Khadija, K-H-A-D-Y-J-A, returned to the house to get some money as the mother had forgotten to bring it when she went shopping. As Nur entered the house, he was ambushed by three of the eight assailants. They tied him up, dragged him upstairs, and shot him twice in the right temple. Like the terrified little boy, Nur died instantly. After murdering Nur, the assassins went upstairs where they discovered three infants sleeping. Two were taken to the bathroom and drowned in the tub. The third infant, a nine-day-old, was drowned in the bathroom sink. Bibi Khalis, B-I-B-I, the mother of the infants, was found in the basement. The killers gagged her and shot her twice in the head. Leaving her for dead, the killers went back to the third floor to check on Almina. This time, they were certain she was dead. Khadija Khalees became concerned when Abdul Noor didn't return to the grocery store. She left the store and rushed to the house where Hamas Khalees was visiting. Together, they hurried home. They knocked, but no one answered. Hamas Khalees peered in a side window and was startled by the sight of a stranger wandering around inside his home. He ordered his wife to go next door to a neighbor's house to call the police. By the time the police arrived, the assassins had vanished. Amina and Bibi Khalees survived the ordeal, though the gunshots left Bibi Khalees paralyzed. Although evidence was left at the scene of the crime, no significant breaks came in the case until Detective Ronald Washington of the District of Columbia Metropolitan Police Department moved temporarily to Philadelphia and infiltrated Mosque No. 12, the mosque the assassins had been linked to. After tracing long-distance telephone calls made by the assassins on the day of the murder, detectives honed in on James Price, a member of the hit team. Price, who was already suspected of a homicide in Philadelphia, confessed to the crimes in June and turned state's witness in July. Based on Price's confessions, the baby killers were soon in custody. The day before Price was scheduled to testify against his co-conspirators, the same man who had called Malcolm X a hypocrite and who stated in the same breath that hypocrites deserve to die, gave a radio sermon on behalf of Elijah Muhammad. During the radio broadcast, which was reportedly heard by Price, Louis X. Farrakhan did not apologize for the dastardly destruction of innocent black babies by black Muslims, but he did have this to say. Avanz then goes on to quote the frankly shocking and disgusting words that Farrakhan had to say vis-a-vis this shocking crime. Quote, "Let this be a warning to those of you who would be used as an instrument of a wicked government against our rise. Be careful, because when the government is tired of you, they're going to dump you back into the laps of your people. And though Elijah Muhammad is a merciful man and will say, 'Come in and forgive you,' yet in the ranks of the black people today, there are younger men and women who have no forgiveness in them for traitors and stool pigeons. And they will execute you as soon as your identity is known," unquote. After hearing Louis X. Farrakhan's radio broadcast, Price refused to testify. The next day, he was found hanged in his cell. So again, although certainly there's nothing implicating Farrakhan in the murder itself, his defense and thinly veiled warning against others who would defy Elijah Muhammad is about as grotesque a stance as one I think could take with regard to this execution of this breakaway, members of this breakaway Muslim sect. And again, I think that behavior like that, as well as the curious behavior of Louis X. Farrakhan vis-a-vis the politics surrounding the death of Malcolm X, the man whose mantle he has assumed, warrants closer scrutiny and investigation than they have received to date. Those of you who are interested in pursuing the various lines of research that I discuss in these segments should contact a tape duplication service called Archives on Audio. They stock a series of documentary tapes consisting of printed sources read on the air, literally extracted, so that listeners can tape the programs and use them as an audio study resource. All of these archive shows are on permanent file with a tape duplication service called Archives on Audio. Their address is P.O. Box 170023. That's in San Francisco. That's 170023, San Francisco, California, 94117-0023. Their phone number is area code 415-346-1840. That's 415-346-1840. Note that there's a 20-page catalog available which lists all of the archive shows, gives a synoptic description of each program, and cross-references the broadcasts with other programs containing similar or related material. Those of you who have access to the World Wide Web can access the material in the Archives on Audio catalog by accessing the web page of KFJC-FM in the San Francisco Bay Area. That's the home base station on which I record these programs, and they have their own page on the World Wide Web, including an interactive section for Archives on Audio, which, as I said, contains all of the archive show descriptions. You can access the KFJC web page as follows. All of these are smaller case letters. http://www.kfjc.org/. www.cygnus.com/kfjc.html. Once again, that's http://www.cygnus.com/kfjc.html. And again, neither myself nor the station gets money out of this arrangement. This is set up FYI. Also, those of you who are interested in pursuing actual books in this field of research are encouraged to contact a book search service called Antifa Books. That's spelled A-N-T-I-F-A. More information about Antifa Books follows.
You can contact the Antifa Book Service at 945 Taravelle Street, number 117, San Francisco, California, 94116. They specialize in books about fascism, the intelligence community, and clandestine power politics. Neither Dave Emery nor KFJC gets money from this arrangement. Again, that's ANTIFA Book Service, 945 Taravelle Street, number 117, San Francisco, California, 94116.
Again, that's Antifa Book Service. That concludes this particular segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.